Yeah, so I mean, this paper is kind of just like is essentially kind of exploiting a coincidence. The reading that I have is kind of based on foreheads and how to do them, and what seems to be like a historical kiss or kind of like a kiss off between what is like a local poetry, so Australian poetics. And what is now like a global art historical discourse, which is conceptual art. And the paper attempts to trace some of the sources that enabled this kiss, give an account of its interest for Forbes's poetics, an account which spills out into the critical reception of the new Australian poetry, as you're talking about. Obviously, a concept which is still operative. So in terms of sources, the poem, yeah, fantastic. The poem, initially at least in terms of composition, has this kind of institutional academic context to it, which is that Forbes is, I think, 22 or 23 years old when it gets published. He's at university. This is the story that he tells. He's like writing an art history paper. He looks up a Renaissance drawing manual. And he kind of like finds like the first line of the poem, which is the classical head, and the kind of like it proceeds from there. So he was studying at the University of Sydney in the early 70s and studying art history, and the space there is the tin sheds, which is the lecture studio practice spaces, printing spaces. For instance, the Earthworks poster collective, event spaces that have poetry readings, music, so on and so forth. So it's like it's a politicized experimental space. And the space was organized by Donald Brook, who worked at the University of Sydney from 1968 until 1973. He founded the Australian Experimental Arts Foundation in Adelaide, I believe. And so he gave this power lecture in 1969 on conceptual art. This lecture was called Flight from the Object. And it's a descriptive analytical account and also like an intervention into conceptual art discourse at the time of its fermentation. So this is 1969. That's the period documented in Lucy Lippard's like 6 years dematerialization of the art object. And the lecture reflects Brooks' attempt to like ground and like aid in a in the best kind of like analytical philosophy sense, like intervene in language helpfully, so on and so forth. But in art historical discourse. So what he does is he basically takes the word object and says, oh, this is being used in seven distinct ways, which are like public, material, real, hermetic, elevated, proper, immutable. Each then has a set of counter concepts that correspond to like the variety of approaches that are being taken up at the time. So to take a couple of examples, so like there's the conception of the public object, which is negated in conceptual work that deals with privacy. For instance, like Leigh Lozano's Dropout piece, where she recorded not participating in the art scene in private journals. Another example would be the hermetic object, which is negated by works that employ site specificity. So then following these two accounts, following these accounts, these like seven categories with their kind of related counter concepts, he gives two interpretive principles. So he gives like two kind of normative like pieces of advice for the future. So the first one is a principle of publicity, where good art will be fundamentally public and therefore democratic in its effects. So he seems to be kind of worried that in Flight from the Object, artists will like neglect making work that is accessible, so on and so forth. And the example that he uses is kind of bizarre, is like people taking drugs instead of making psychedelic art. In any case, something we could talk about with Forbes. Then the But the second one, which is kind of relevant to the poem, is he talks about what he calls a principle of exploration, in which, so this flight from various conceptions of the art object, like running away from or negating various ideas about the art object, is going to open up new possibilities for art. You know, so he's very positive about this, with a kind of proviso. You know, it's like it's a necessary but not sufficient condition for good art is this, you know, this principle of exploring these possibilities if we can kind of get away from these different ideas about the art object. So the Brooks lecture is in 1969. Forbes poem is in first published in 1972. And the poem, I think, fairly clearly, like, takes up, so you can read it as a direct riposte to the Brooks lecture. Explicitly in the like numbered sections 6 to 8, which enter into the whether the dematerialized head. So the poem is kind of sets up this head, and then it tells you, well, no, but the head is not real. Like, you can't touch it, you can't feel it. Oh, it's trapped inside your head, like so on and so forth. And then the head sets sail on us in this kind of emergent semantic space. Which is set out in section 5. So he talks about there's a gap between the usage and head in the stars and head of lettuce in the word head. So it's a parody. So one way of reading it would be, okay, he's parodically engaging with the kind of imperial rhetoric that Brooke is using when he talks about exploration. Like, oh, we'll have a principle of exploration. Which Forbes is kind of hyperbolistically inflating to the point that the subject of the address, which is you, you know, you are greater than all Magellans in your conceptual work. You are commencing an adventure more huge and intricate, intricate than the complete idea, of Mount Everest. Your work is incredible. So, given that I read the poem in primarily negative terms, staging a number of like critiques of the conceptual as a paradigm. And I guess just one fact that I wonder about is like, 1969 to 72, like Brooke doesn't use the term conceptual art, for instance. And obviously this emerges as a hegemonic kind of usage to denote a set of practices, which seems to be fairly clearly talking about here. So that seems to happen in that time. Although it's possible that Brooke doesn't talk about it because conceptual art, like, is not statements about conceptual arts are not statements about objects, which then are kind of outside of his like analytical framework or whatever. to talk about form for a second. I guess I see a tension in this section of the poem. If you've read the poem or you have it available to you, you'll see that there's something going on in terms of lines. So each portrait, each section of the poem is a head and starts out with the classical head, which is couplets with some run-on lines. And then in the romantic head, you have groupings of three lines, trivia, and then there's a symbolist head, which is like a dense slab. But you get into here with a conceptual art, you get a numbered section form, which is definitely also, I would say, like another parodic move. So typical in conceptual art, you have like soloists, sentences on conceptual art, a set of numbered sentences that are programmatic declarations about what conceptual art might or could be or is not. This is fairly typical of like a number of different kind of texts that are now canonically regarded as conceptual art. So the form of the numbered section in the conceptual head section invites you to read back against, invites you to disavow the enjambment and spacing of the poem. Like, if you read it as a set of programmatic statements, you have to ignore the fact that there are line breaks, for instance. Then alternatively, you would say, well, actually what it does is reintroducing enjambment back into programmatic statements. And you could use that, for instance, to read the material history of conceptual art. What's that about? That's not interesting. Maybe other people in the room can say other things about the history of the reception of the poem, but things that I find interesting are that apparently it was performed on stage. It was in some fashion. Apparently, Megan Morris used this poem to teach semiotics, which would have been at the kind of like early, thanks Astrid, which is a pretty early use of semiotics in classrooms, I would imagine, in the 1970s. And that at this very young, 23-year-old poet, he won the Poetry Society Award, which was the organ that the kind of new editorial clique of the Poetry Society were using to, in a kind of editorial way. So in 1970, they gave it to John A. Scott. They gave it to Laurie Duggan in 71. That's one of the ways in which that journal kind of signaled its changes. It was Poetry Magazine before it was New Poetry. I mean, this is kind of arcane gossip. There's a kind of critical employment of this poem that I kind of want to sketch out vaguely. Or maybe not vaguely, but it's a vague employment, I suppose. There's this essay published in 1972, a couple of issues before they print Foreheads, by Carl Harrison Ford, who's the leading editor of the magazine, what he calls a like tentative and hopefully provocative set of notes, originally assembled as the introduction to an anthology of conceptual poems. This anthology was going to come out in the 1970s, in 1972, and it was going to be called a conceptual poetry anthology. Wow. what's interesting about this essay, first of all, to me, is just simply the term. The term now is ubiquitous, but it's being used in a weird way in the 1970s. But the essay fails to cite any precedent usage, so it doesn't make any references, it doesn't make any direct citations to conceptual art, doesn't make any direct citations to any philosophical usage of the term conceptual or concept. And what it does do is like totally anticipate the anthology, The New Australian Poetry, that Anne mentioned yesterday, in terms of Tranter's arguments about belated modernism, other things I'll talk about in a second. And interestingly, this essay was going to be the introduction to a set of poems that were to be edited and selected by John Tranter, according to this document in the magazine. Tranter was going to introduce it, but Carl Harrison Ford writes, the anthology did not materialize. And that use of the word materialize is the only reference I can see to any conceptual art discourse, as in dematerialization. So what we have is like a conceptual anthology in the sense that it failed to materialize. It's cute. It's a cute joke. This use of the term conceptual in the 1970s that isn't mapped to art necessarily is novel. It's strange. And part of what's strange is that Carl Harrison Ford treats conceptual poetry as like a commonplace recognizable object, like that you should be able to recognize already. So he says, that writing which is usually thought of as conceptual and which frequently is about itself, that verse which is often termed conceptual, such conceptual works, so on and so forth, what is involved in much conceptual writing? So it reads as a kind of facticity. This is already there. It's already part of the conversation. But I think it's also possible that maybe it's a rhetorical strategy to hide the neologistic use of the term. It's difficult to tell without more evidence, obviously. But there's a, and it's, this paper is based on this paranoid claim, I suppose, that at least one source for the use of conceptual by Carl Harrison Ford is this poem, which is published after the essay appears. So the idea is that this poem was available to him beforehand and shaped his, he was like, oh, like conceptual poetry, like that's a great idea for an anthology, so on and so forth. To flesh this out a little bit more in terms of what the conceptual means here, it's similar to Taranta's argument for the new Australian poetry in the 79 anthology. So Carl Harrison Ford suggests that like new poetry is out there. It's just not in Australia. Though he establishes this kind of different pedigree. So like Taranta might say like Mallarmé, and Carl Harrison Ford will say, oh, like Zukofsky is new. Taranta talks about the New York School. Carl Harrison Ford doesn't. He talks about William Carlos Williams. So he's appealing to a different set of priorities, but the general arguments are very similar. So, but he, basically he says it's like, the account is this pastiche of sources on literary modernism that were available at the time that anticipates this idea, which you find in Taranta, that modernism is like an unstable phenomena exemplified by like a reflexive, disarming set of formal features and, as you were saying, a kind of amoral. There's this argument about moralism in poetry and how the new Australian poetry is amoral. It doesn't enforce morals on people. Oh, wow, crazy. Where are we? So it gives a number of different quotations. Perhaps they're not worth reading. The basic idea is that for Carl Harrison Ford, conceptual poetry is self-reflexive. It's like an Ouroboros, the snake eating itself, like a principled, but then that abstracted to the level of a principle, which would be self-negating. This is the instability that they're interested in. Which kind of leads him to say basically like, this is a quote, modernist writing, which is the paradigm for conceptual poetry that he's talking about, can create no tradition of its own without ceasing to be modern. It cannot establish a style of its own without contradicting itself. One way it can cope with life in a constant present in which there is not ordering, but just openness, is by looking inward. And at one point he talks about conceptual poems as being incestuous. But it seems that the like masturbation is a better model, I think, than incest for what he's talking about. I guess modernism here, I guess I think about this in terms of Michael's work. Like, what are these people, what do people do when they make claims about Australian poetry that are validated through, kind of like valorized temporal paradigms that like more or less have no like social or material basis in Australian poetry. What it does in terms of Carl Harrison Ford is it provides model behavior that he can prescribe to young poets. Poets who are basically his contemporaries, but at the end of the essay, he basically, again, like this is a theme in Tranter as well, slams the Little Magazine scene, goes through and tells people that their work is ultimately, like, not interesting, people are writing derivative trash, so on and so forth. I guess I haven't really made my argument. Thank you. I will make this paranoid argument in 1 minute. So I guess this is the argument that Carl Harrison Ford is drawing on this poem in terms of this concept of conceptual poetry. So he's throwing all of these quotations at you just like to see what is going to stick. And there is something that kind of sticks to four heads, which is that he talks about Menippean satire, which he draws out of a quotation, like a dashed off quotation from Northrop Frye. And this is a term that's kind of central for Fry because it's the term that he thinks is not a good term, so he calls it anatomy instead, like the novelistic mode of anatomy, a cynical amassing of social details. So Menippean satire, this is a quote from Fry, deals less with people as such than with mental attitudes. Peasants, bigots, cranks, parvenus, virtuosi, enthusiasts, rapacious and incompetent professional men of all kinds are handled in terms of their occupational approach to life as distinct from their social behavior. Menippean satire thus resembles the confession in its ability to handle abstract ideas and theories. Differs from the novel because it's stylized, whereas like the novel is naturalistic, and presents people as mouthpieces of the ideas they represent. So it has that allegorical material. David Lodge calls it like a satire on literature itself, which is like I think the straightest way possible of reading Four Heads. There's a term. Okay, this is terrible. This is not 1 minute. This will be the final point. There's a Seneca text called the... excuse me. There's a Seneca text called the Apocalypsintosis, which is translated as the gourdification or pumpkinification of the Emperor Claudius. He dies and is subject to ridicule. This is a Menippean satire. Whether Menippean satire sticks, I mean, it's a novelistic term for Fry. I think pumpkinification is an interesting way of approaching this particular poem, which is that it presents positions as kind of like abstract ideals attached to heads or carved into the front of them. And it seems that, at least in terms of Carl Harrison Ford's arguments, he hasn't really picked up on the critical material that's embedded in the satire here, that instead he's taken up the term conceptual poetry and run with it, whereas Forbes is, I think, basically saying goodbye to you, like, staid orthodoxy. I'll have to leave it there. Thank you.